This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Breech vaginal deliveries.
Wow.
There's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah.
But first, what's the thing we do for no reason?
All right. Well, we've talked around this before, but how about telling pregnant women not to eat sushi? Didn't you want to talk more about this? I know we mentioned it, but it's more nuanced maybe than we spent the time on.
Yes, actually. It's been on my radar for a while. I got initially very curious about this when I was practicing obstetrics in Japan, where sushi is basically like a national treasure. And then, of course, when I myself also got pregnant while still living in Japan. So we've already talked about the mercury exposure from fish consumption in pregnancy in a prior episode. But for that, we weren't trying to single out raw fish. We were just talking about fish in general, whether cooked or raw. So the sushi thing that I want to talk about today, it's not so much about the fact that is there too much mercury in there, but about the fact of it being raw fish.
Okay, and just to recap, our conclusion was that even for the highest mercury-containing fish, these are the big fish in the sea, you'd have to eat more than a full serving every day in order to reach toxic levels that would potentially harm the fetus. Unless there's been an unlawful toxic chemical dump in that fish's environment, which did happen, as we mentioned, a few years ago in an industrial city in Japan. So it could be a thing, but for the most part, it isn't.
Yeah, and so we've established that for most kinds of commercially available fish that you can buy to eat, it's safe and even beneficial to eat it in pregnancy at least several times a week. But the CDC and ACOG still recommend total avoidance of raw fish in pregnancy, and they cite a concern for parasites and listeria. And the big parasitic disease we learn about in med school and learn to fear it, especially for the embryo toxicity, is toxoplasmosis.
Right, which can cause serious and permanent neurologic injury in a baby, especially the earlier the pregnancy is infected. And I will say that it's interesting to me, some of the big traditional things we learn in med school are emphasized because they were really a big deal in the 1950s and 60s and 70s when we were just learning about things and becoming really scientific. And then by scale, a lot of other things are equally important, but they came about later and they were more contextualized when we understood the statistics better. So we do emphasize a lot of things that maybe lack the need for emphasis. But are you saying that this is one of them? How worried should we be?
Well, for sushi, we really shouldn't be worried about toxo. It's rarely, if ever, found in the sushi fish. It is more likely to be found in like oysters and clams and shellfish that are raw, and also undercooked beef or lamb or other game, and then anything else that would touch those undercooked things and not be washed. So like a food prep surface or utensils or even any side dishes like veggies that touched it. And the other buzzword we learn about for toxo is kitty litter. Although I couldn't find what's the actual incidence of people getting sick with toxo from changing their kitty litter. So I don't know if that's still a common thing, but we do want pregnant women to avoid changing cat litter if possible. And soil exposure is really the common risk factor between all of these different things, the beef, lamb, kitty litter, and even the shellfish. So I guess I would also say if a pregnant woman goes like strawberry picking, shouldn't just eat them straight, like wash her hands, wash the strawberries first.
Well, a lot of things have risks, and toxo, I think, is really more of a risk for older stale litter, especially for inside-outside cats that may bring that contamination back in. But I do think we have to understand the statistics a bit and contextualize them. It's a risk of walking outside in the rain that you'll get hit with lightning, but, you know, we all take certain risks in life, and so we can't live our lives avoiding all risk altogether. I will say toxo is actually pretty common. Something like 6% of every school age and older person in the U.S. has had it at some point, and it usually just causes very mild symptoms like body aches. So my guess is lots of cats then are exposed to it, especially, like I said, the inside-out cats. But the good thing is that if you've ever been infected before, and then you get pregnant and get re-exposed, then you'll actually be protected due to immunity from prior infection. But then some of the new first-time infections in pregnancy can be problematic. Still rare, though. But even if toxo isn't found that much in sushi, what about other parasites? You said parasites and toxo.
Yeah, so the main parasite that would be found in sushi fish like tuna or salmon is called Anisakis. And this, if a human ingests it and gets ill, it's just going to cause a GI illness in the mother, like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. It's not going to infect the fetus like toxo would. Sometimes Anisakis can also cause an allergic reaction, which can be anything from mild to severe. So that is also something to watch out for. But over 90% of all human cases of illness of this happen in Japan. And then one of the next highest rates, which is much lower, but in the world, the next highest rate would be in Spain, actually, because there's a marinated anchovy dish that's commonly eaten there. So the common denominator there is raw fish. But these Anisakis parasites are actually visible to the naked eye. So a professional sushi chef learns to cut the fish in a way that they would both see and kill the parasite if it's there, and then make it unable to infect anyone that eats it. But I don't know if there's quite as many professionally trained sushi chefs in the US or Europe as there are in Japan. So actually, there's a requirement in the US at least, and maybe Europe too, that fish for sushi at least would get frozen before it gets prepared. And this would also kill the Anisakis parasite. In Japan, this freezing thing is recommended, but it's not a requirement, I guess, because they already have the sushi chef way to prevent the parasitic disease. And they also claim, at least, that freezing the fish and then thawing it would affect the taste in some way.
Well, I suppose it might be tempting to blame the higher incidence of parasite illnesses in Japan for the fact that they don't require flash freezing for their fish, but it's also, I'm sure, just because they consume so much more of it than we do, so the incidence would naturally be higher. So it'd be hard to know if those cases come from the fish that wasn't prepared by a professional master or sushi chef, or whether that's just the 0.1 in 10,000, whatever risk, whatever the rate is, but still happens with perfect sushi preparation, but people eat so much of it. Anisakiasis is so rare, in fact, that I don't think there's a published incidence to even be found, so we can only speculate what the rate would be if we ate as much fish as the average Japanese person does. And maybe with flash freezing, it would still be lower, though. But I have noticed a difference in the taste of fresh and frozen sushi. I'm not an expert, but there's a difference.
Well, I'm not a sushi connoisseur. If you did a side-by-side taste test, I would not be able to tell which one was previously frozen. I just care about the toppings. But I also don't know if any of these considerations as far as freezing and slicing them a certain way would also apply to ceviche, which was at least more, I found it a lot in California, maybe not so much on the East Coast, but that's a raw fish marinated in citrus spice kind of dish. So maybe that one depends on what kind of fish is used as to whether there's a risk of getting parasites from that. But the main point is the only parasite that could seriously harm a fetus, which is toxo, is not found in these fish. It's just in the raw oysters and things like the shellfish. So the only thing we're really preventing by having pregnant women totally avoid sushi is just plain old food poisoning, whether it is from the Anisakis parasite or from a bacteria or virus. And all of that is just, it's going to be nausea, vomiting, diarrhea that'll make the mom sick, but it will not infect the baby.
And that's how I've always understood it personally, was that food poisoning from sushi sucks when you're already pregnant, because it can be pretty bad.
Yeah.
So don't eat the sketch sushi, the three-day-old from Kroger that's on discount maybe if you're pregnant.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then what about, speaking of bacteria, what about Listeria?
Yeah, so Listeria, it can be bad. It can make anyone sick, and it's worse in pregnancy. It can cause a mom to have high fever and even infect the uterus and cause preterm labor and early delivery or even pregnancy loss. And I've seen that happen. It wasn't from sushi, though, in that case. But Salmonella can do all of those same things, too. And that is found in sushi, just as Listeria is. But both Listeria and Salmonella are much more common in other foods that we probably don't emphasize as much as we tend to emphasize sushi. So there was a Norwegian study looking at Listeria levels in various sushi products, and they found that the only specimens where Listeria became high enough to cause human illness were in fish that were stored unfrozen longer than 7 days. And of course, how would we know that if we're in a restaurant or buying it from the store? How long was this in storage for? This study says that raw tuna and raw halibut are generally allowed, in quotes, to be stored for more than 7 days, just refrigerated, but other commercial fish species are not. And I haven't fact-checked that, but that's what they said in this study. So that might be one way to know If it's tuna or halibut, it might have been stored for more than 7 days. But another thing to note is that vinegar inhibits listeria from growing, and sushi rolls are just the fish or whatever the filling is wrapped in vinegar marinated rice. So it's effectively inhibiting the growth of listeria. But on the other hand, listeria is also lurking around in lots of other favorite American foods that don't have any vinegar put on them. So think of a lot of different cold meats, like roast beef or hot dogs, also melons, apparently, and then any soft unpasteurized cheeses, and then anything else that has touched that stuff, like I think especially raw veggies that were sitting next to those things.
I will say that if you do a Google News search of listeria outbreak, just to see what's happened in the last few months or where these are, you'll find that Cadbury desserts have been recalled for listeria concerns. Mm-hmm. Kale, spinach, and collard greens have all been recalled by different companies due to these concerns. There's been ice cream, Saber hummus, lots of different things that are related to that. And smoked fish, I'm just reading through just dozens of things, different sorts of cheeses. It's all over the place. Enoki mushrooms. This is just from today's Google News feed. So listeria is everywhere, but to contextualize again, we think that one pregnancy out of 5 or 6 million in the United States might actually be affected per year by listeria in terms of causing a miscarriage, according to CDC data. And that's probably in a country where people are not really self-restricting. I mean, they might avoid soft cheeses and things like that, but that's even after they've gone to the doctor and maybe been told that. So it's not a huge burden of disease. But the vinegar trick is good to know. So if I go to Subway and I tell them to put oil and vinegar all over my meatball sub, then I'm good, right? Because the vinegar thing.
I mean, it could probably inhibit any further listeria from growing, but I don't know if it'll kill what's already on there. But I have not heard of listeria outbreaks connected to a Subway really ever. I don't know if that's ever happened. But just to follow this whole line of advice, I think probably the best bet for a pregnant woman eating at Subway would be a hot sandwich, because that's another that will kill the listeria, whereas the vinegar just inhibits it. Hot sandwich, maybe a soup, but if you're avoiding the cold meats, then also don't get the cold salad that was prepared right next to those meats.
And wash your kale and lettuce and yes, things like that. And you can't prepare and reduce all of your risks for everything in life. And you also have to, if you really enjoy eating something, buy it from a reputable source, prepackaged, things like that. These companies are doing all the best they can to avoid outbreaks, obviously, because they don't want to be on the Google News feed and have to do recalls. But there may be some risk of food poisoning from sushi, it sounds like, is the bottom line, but nothing that would directly infect or harm the fetus, and nothing that isn't more common in many other foods that you might get.
Yeah. So I think we should at least be fair and balanced with our recommendations and really try to talk about the highest yield things. So the raw shellfish, as we mentioned earlier, not only does it have a risk of causing toxoplasmosis, which can permanently harm the baby, but also lots of other just generic food poisoning cases as well. So we would want to eliminate raw shellfish from the table. But after that, the risk of getting any food poisoning at all really is like 1,000 times higher from eating cooked chicken than it is from eating raw sushi. And I don't know that it's realistic to aim for 0% food poisoning in pregnancy. As you mentioned, pretty much everything has been recalled at some point or other. So we would have to tell pregnant women, don't eat anything if you want to avoid food poisoning. And that's obviously not good. So I think the most logical advice would be to emphasize, again, that make sure the fruits and veggies are washed, dairy is pasteurized, make sure your meat is hot and cooked. But if you're a sushi lover, really your risk of even a temporary illness, just a little stomach upset, is going to be very low, much lower than if you're eating cooked chicken, especially if you're having like a fresh roll of sushi rolled in that rice. And maybe especially if you're at a decently good restaurant, one that has like the little health inspection grade posted somewhere, compared to like it's expired, packaged in a gas station. And sashimi too, that is not quite as covered with the rice. That's just a slab of the fish sitting on top. So maybe for extra protection, go for the roll instead of the sashimi. And I don't know, maybe I won't comment on ceviche because I didn't look as much into that. I don't know, is it typically covered in vinegar or not, how it's prepared? But if you Google it, everything on Google will say avoid ceviche in pregnancy.
Well, there's always those deep fried sushi rolls or vegetarian rolls too, if people are skittish. you can definitely still go to a sushi restaurant in pregnancy and find something to enjoy and be very conservative in your approach. But my feeling is that this is another example of professional societies overdoing it on safety recommendations just as far as possible inside a certain margin of safety. Just like with the minimal fish consumption recommendations that we talked about for avoiding mercury, sometimes the recommendations are so extreme that they backfire. And people take risks. You and I have talked before about queso and listeria, and quite literally, you take more of a risk of driving to your doctor's office if you live, what we figured out, 14 miles away or something like that. You take more of a risk of driving to your prenatal visits that you'll get in a car accident and get killed than you would from eating some of these foods. So people have different risk tolerances, and people also sometimes like sushi.
Yeah, and I know that sometimes people have to drive, but it's almost like if we're going to tell people to avoid sushi, then we should also be telling them, don't drive if you don't have to. Like if you're just going for a drive for fun, you're probably, that's a much bigger risk than eating sushi. So anyway.
Yeah, and I'm aware of, in one state out west, I'm aware of a maternal death that's being attributed to pregnancy related because she died while falling asleep at the wheel driving back from a prenatal visit.
Aww.
Now, in that case, she did have something like a two-hour drive because there's a maternity desert there.
That's terrible.
So I can understand the argument for it, but life has some risk to it, and mm-hmm. we should be realistic and tell people the numbers needed to treat and harm so that they can make their own informed decisions.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to our main topic, the breech vaginal delivery and just general management of breech pregnancies at term. You just went to the annual clinic and scientific meeting in Baltimore. I wasn't able to go this time, but you had gone to a session about planned breech vaginal delivery. So how did you like that?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. This is a group that's done about 80 or so breeches over the last decade that were planned and elective deliveries, if you will. They did talk about three things, at least, that I think were a bit controversial. Before I get into that, I will say that they also emphasized external cephalic version. We'll talk about that maybe on another episode. They still advocate for ECV as being the main management or preferred management of these pregnancies if possible. But the three things was, one was avoiding Pitocin at all costs, as well as epidurals. They talked about both of those as if they were bad things. The second was that they're delivering these patients in the all fours position on their hands and knees rather than the dorsal lithotomy position that we would traditionally use. And the third was a claim that the all fours position made the pelvis a couple of centimeters bigger than the dorsal lithotomy position, and that's why it was beneficial to women in labor. They also didn't really talk about any outcome data from their institution, just more about what they've been doing. And I think a lot of hospitals have been working on this around the world in terms of providing a safe breech delivery program for patients who really desire it rather than an automatic cesarean. And that's necessary increasingly because what will happen if you don't have the opportunity for women to do this is they'll attempt it as a home breech delivery and avoid hospitals altogether if it's not offered. So a lot of institutions are interested in creating as safe an option as possible for women.
Well, that's interesting. So collectively, OBGYNs in the U.S. do not routinely offer breech delivery for women with singleton pregnancies. Obviously, we do breech extractions for second twins, where we still require that the first twin comes out head first, but then we can take the second twin out either head first or breech first or feet first. But that's quite different than an intentional breech singleton delivery. Every once in a while, there's someone that does show up with a singleton and they're like already pushing the breech out and there's really no time to do anything else. So we do still have to understand how to do it for those more rare scenarios as well. But we routinely do not recommend people try to do that if they can choose a different way.
Yeah, I think we should talk first about the current position of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists regarding breech delivery to contextualize these comments.
Yeah, so that's committee opinion number 745 that was last updated in 2018. And that's where you'll find ACOG's recommendation, which they essentially say that the decision about mode of delivery in the setting of a breech singleton should respect patient wishes and also take into consideration the experience of the healthcare team. And they state that women should be offered an external cephalic version, which should only take place where immediate cesarean is available. And then most importantly, they say that planned vaginal delivery of a term singleton breech fetus may be reasonable under hospital-specific protocol guidelines for eligibility and for labor management. And they go on to say that if you do that, you should have a detailed, informed consent that includes the risks of morbidity and death of the baby, and that those risks may be higher with vaginal than with planned cesarean.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people stop right there and think, why would you ever offer or allow a reach delivery if the risks to the newborn are higher? But again, I would remind you that the risks of morbidity and death to the newborn are much higher with a trial of labor after cesarean, a VBAC, compared to planned cesarean delivery or compared to even planned breech vaginal delivery, yet we routinely do that. And that's because cesarean deliveries themselves are not without risk to the mother. We're always balancing in OB the risks between the mother and the fetus. And so it's not an irrational decision for a woman to choose a trial of labor after cesarean to avoid the risks of cesarean delivery and the risks to future pregnancies, nor is it always an irrational decision for a woman to choose a reach vaginal delivery rather than the risks of a planned cesarean delivery and the risks to her for future pregnancies.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of us practicing really think about that, because we often will happily support a TOLAC even in some cases after two prior cesareans, where those risks are even higher with uterine rupture and everything. But we completely will almost not even mention that breech vaginal delivery is an option. Like, oh, the ECV failed, we're going to book you for a C-section. There you go. But there was a time when all breech babies were born by vaginal delivery, and now around 90% of them are born by cesarean. So why don't you give us a little historical segment here and tell us what happened to flip that number?
People are going to think I'm old with these historical segments. Well, so cesarean delivery by breech presentation wasn't really a concept and as recently as 1950, when cesarean delivery was still relatively rare and relatively morbid. But after 1950 or so, due to antibiotics and all the other things that made cesareans safer in terms of surgical innovations, well, cesarean delivery became an increasingly safe option for mothers, and neonatal deaths were becoming less and less common, and the tolerance for any negative outcomes to newborns was becoming rarer and rarer. And so doing cesarean deliveries for even a small incremental neonatal benefit started to become the standard of care, not just with breeches, but in every domain.
Yeah, so the cesarean rate in 1950 was only about 2.5% compared to today. It's well over 20% on average. But even in 1970, it was still not that much higher. It was only like 5.5%. So around, if you look at textbooks from 1965 or so, in those textbooks, it was still expected that a breech presenting baby would be born vaginally.
Yeah, that's right. So it's really between 1975 and the year 2000, which is interesting, that breech vaginal delivery became increasingly less recommended. And also during that time, that people who were trained and comfortable doing breech deliveries became less and less common because they all were retiring. So a few important studies. In 1974, Brenner and colleagues published a paper looking at 1,016 breech deliveries at the University Hospitals of Cleveland, although Brenner was in North Carolina at the time. And breech-presenting fetuses did worse, both in the antepartum and intrapartum time period and in the neonatal time period in terms of deaths and negative outcomes. In fact, as you might expect, congenital anomalies were three times more common in the breech delivery group than in the non-breech delivery group, which accounts for some of those outcomes. But still, the overall mortality rate in the breech pregnancies was 25.4% compared to 2.4% for those fetuses who had non-breech deliveries.
All right. Well, even 2% perinatal mortality sounds really high. That if I had that in any of my hospitals, that we would think that there's something seriously wrong. But 25% that's not good.
Well, it's a different era. And I think people who are alive today don't really understand what pregnancy used to be like. But yeah, I thought 25 was crazy too, but I got the paper and read it. It's a huge number. But when you look at the paper, which is wonderful in so many ways, I have a lot of good things to say about it. But most of those losses, as you might expect, occurred at earlier gestations. And then they were induced or labored and delivered breech, so they were counted in the breech deliveries, and a baby's likely to be breech when it is a fetal demise at an early gestational age. So many of these were just breech babies that were born demised at 20 to 32 weeks. So we need to focus on the near-term group. So if you look at just 36 to 43 weeks, there was still infants and newborns dying in the breech vaginal delivery group to the tune of 2.4% and 1.3% respectively. compared to no deaths at all in the cesarean section group. And that's the number to pick up on that people noticed. So at a time when cesarean delivery was becoming safer and safer, the fact that there were any babies dying as part of a near-term or term delivery was unacceptable. And this had a chilling effect on intentional breech vaginal deliveries. Another paper in 1973 by Rovinsky and colleagues looked just at babies who were more than 2,500 grams, so that's a surrogate often for term pregnancies, and they found an overall 3.17% perinatal mortality rate for breech vaginal delivery compared to babies who were born cephalic, where the rate was only 0.84%, so about three times higher. A third of those deaths, they thought, were directly related to the mode of delivery. In other words, they could look at it and say, gosh, if we had done a cesarean, this baby wouldn't have died. So this came from things like prolapse cord and obviously head entrapment. And at the same time, they didn't see those deaths happening with babies who were born by cesarean.
We should note here that these were not randomized controlled trials. So a lot of that excessive breech morbidity may have been due, like you said, to higher rates of congenital anomalies that would tend to make the babies more likely to be breech and then also more likely to pass away. And so not every case would a baby have been saved by cesarean, but still in enough of them, you said at least a third of them, it was clear that the baby was normal in every other way. The breech delivery caused their death. We should also point out, though, that in the early 1970s, emergency cesarean was not really available at most hospitals, so they wouldn't have in-house anesthesia like we tend to have now. So if you declared the need for an emergency cesarean for, like, let's say a cord prolapse or something, it might take an hour or two to get the staff there to do it in the 1970s. So we would not expect to see babies dying of cord prolapse today in the U.S., but in the 1970s, even with cesarean being safer, it just wasn't as available. So it definitely was more common back then.
Well, as you said, this was all just observational data that they were publishing, and people criticized it for that reason and continued doing breaches if they had been doing them. But again, throughout the 1970s, these studies and others made most people increasingly favor cesarean delivery. By 1978, some folks were arguing for a set of strict selective criteria about who would be a candidate for a breech delivery. And then there was a study published that year by Lyons and Papson that showed that with good patient selection, with strict criteria, you could still deliver about 40% of your breeches by the vaginal route and not experience death. But there was still an increased rate of overall morbidity, and some of which was serious. So by the 1980s, this was all very controversial for really the next two decades. There's also external things that go on, and I'll mention just briefly, I'm sure a lot of people have read John Edwards' book, Four Trials. The book wasn't published until 2003 when he wrote it, but John Edwards, of course, ran for president, etc., but he made his mark by suing obstetricians and invented the bad baby lawsuit. And so it's a very interesting book. It's a well-written book. And one of the stories is about a woman he calls Jennifer, one of his first early medical malpractice lawsuits. I think it was maybe his first actual med-mal lawsuit. And it was about a doctor, an older doctor, who didn't perform a cesarean. He'd performed breaches his whole life, but it was like a footling breach, if I recall, didn't meet good criteria. And the baby was damaged in the birth. And so people were hearing about things like that. All of a sudden, you were getting sued for breech deliveries, and John Edwards was very infamous for this, and other cases happened too. So the 1980s, breech was very controversial, and cesarean was taking off, and so we kind of got to where we are today eventually.
Very interesting.
There were still people doing selective breeches with very strict criteria, though. The older guys still persisted.
Yeah, and that would include things like radiographic evidence that the pelvis was adequate. Probably in that era, it would have been x-rays, or maybe at least just having a prior proven pelvis, and then usually avoiding certain positions, like if the baby was a footling breech, that's a lot higher risk of cord accident or even incomplete breech.
Yeah, but still that was mainly favored by older docs who had grown up that way. And over time, those experienced folks faded away, comfort levels faded away, and it became increasingly a thing of the past. So finally, in the year 2000, though, for all the naysayers, there was a trial, a famous trial called the Term Breech Trial, which seemed to be the death knell in breech vaginal deliveries. Most professional organizations afterwards just recommended that women with persistent breech presentation undergo planned cesarean delivery after that trial was published.
And that's not what the current ACOG opinion is on that. So ACOG has definitely changed their tune since the term breech trial initially came out. But when it came out, it was before either of us had trained, and it definitely changed the landscape for practicing and even training on breech vaginal deliveries. It was really the first significant trial to take a randomized approach to vaginal versus cesarean for persistent breech pregnancies.
Yeah, there had been a couple of small randomized trials before this trial that we're talking about by Hannah. There had been a paper by Collia and colleagues published in the Gray Journal in 1990, and another trial published in 83 in the Gray Journal by Gimofsky. And those trials and a subsequent Cochrane review of them found no benefit to cesarean delivery for well-selected breeches. So that's why Hannah and colleagues did this randomized trial, and they randomized 2,088 women with breech fetuses in 26 countries, and that may be a criticism of the study's different resource levels, at 121 hospitals to either a planned cesarean or a planned vaginal birth. And they found that an aggregate outcome of that consisted of perinatal mortality, neonatal mortality, or serious morbidity was lower in the planned cesarean group than for the planned vaginal group. And the difference was 1.6% in the cesarean group versus 5% in the vaginal group, so about a threefold difference. At the same time, they found no real difference between maternal mortality or morbidity, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to capture a maternal death in just 2,000 cesareans. So that was it. That was all she wrote for breech deliveries.
So out of the study population, there were 16 total deaths of babies, either before or after birth. And these were only of non-anomalous, like normal babies. Three of those deaths were with the cesarean deliveries, and then the other 13 were with the breech vaginal births. A couple of them were babies who were born healthy, went home healthy, but then died of probably or presumably unrelated causes, like maybe SIDS or something. And a couple of them also were otherwise unexplained intrauterine deaths, so even before the delivery process began. But clearly, a lot of them were related to difficult vaginal deliveries. Of the three that died with cesarean, two of them had been allocated to that cesarean group and died despite undergoing an elective planned cesarean. And I don't know the details of that. Maybe it was just such a difficult cesarean that they died in that process. One of the three deaths in the cesarean group was allocated to vaginal, and it was not going well, and they converted to cesarean, but then the baby still died. And then another woman who had been allocated to cesarean actually ended up undergoing a vaginal delivery instead before the cesarean could be done. So I think she went into labor early. And then that was one of the deaths in the vaginal group.
Yeah, so in any event, the Hannah paper changed what we do, and now it's been 20 years since anyone's really done very many breech deliveries in practice or in training. There were criticisms that followed after the paper was published, for sure. For starters, there was a significant lack of adherence to the set of strict criteria that they had developed for vaginal birth, and also poor adherence to best labor guidelines and things like that. So it was easy to go back and look at some of those individual cases and say, well, you shouldn't have done that one or things like that. The same group also later published a follow-up analysis of pediatric outcomes in which they were able to find no reduction in the risk of death or neurodevelopmental delay in children by the age of two, which raised a lot of questions about their aggregate outcome and some of the supposed benefits that they found. Those reductions in some of those outcomes in NICU things that stays like that, they didn't translate apparently into real-world observable differences for the children. And though they reported no differences in maternal outcomes, when you went back later and used multiple logistic regression analysis modeling, they did find that maternal morbidity was lowest in the vaginal birth group, which you would expect, and highest in the C-section group with an odds ratio of 3.3. So criticisms did come after that and, again, rekindled, I think, a little bit of interest in vaginal breech deliveries.
Yeah, it's a shame that they couldn't have shown what would happen if they actually did adhere to the recommended selection criteria and labor management. Because after you get a study like this, people are going to be too scared to repeat the study and all the risks that could come with that. But it's the comparison between the potential adverse consequences to the newborn versus to the mother, where that risk-benefit decision has to be made. And in the Netherlands, they significantly changed their practice after this paper came out, but also they have really great public health records and data management. And so they were able to quickly figure out that the number needed to treat was 338, meaning that you'd have to do 338 cesareans for breech babies to prevent one perinatal death that's attributed to breech vaginal delivery. So I don't know. A lot of people, I think, would still say, yes, do the cesarean for me. But in the same population of women, severe maternal morbidity occurred in 6.4 per 1,000 elective cesareans for breech, compared to 3.9 per 1,000 in the attempted vaginal. And that even includes ones that converted to cesarean. And along with that, a threefold increased risk of severe maternal morbidity for those cesarean women in their next pregnancies. So it is a trade-off, just like anything else in life.
And like with TOLAC and repeat cesarean, those risks are not equally distributed to mom and baby. The risks of the breech or the risks of the TOLAC fall mainly on the fetus, the newborn, and the risks of the cesarean fall mainly to the mother. And you're right, most women will always take the risk for their child rather than put the risk on their child. But there is a trade-off, and it's not like there is a riskless way of proceeding. But now, since there's an increased interest again in understanding who the best candidates for breech delivery might be, and because patients are wanting this and choosing maybe to go home if they don't get it, then we do need to have a process where we can give informed decision-making information to the patient about the true risks and benefits and how they apply to that individual patient's case. So there's a lot to this and a lot of other things we could talk about, but needless to say, we probably have not perfectly yet identified the populations of women who would most benefit from breech vaginal delivery versus those who are harmed by it. We definitely know some people who shouldn't attempt breech vaginal deliveries. I'll put a link to a paper from BMC Pregnancy and Childbirth in 2020 that's sort of an excellent review of this controversy and has a lot more detail in it than we've discussed. But again, it should suffice to say that there are a lot of institutions around the world who are now revisiting this and offering a program of breech delivery for women who really desire it and who are appropriately counseled. And that's, again, in a world where women may go to home birth options with a less trained provider and poor resources for the baby if they aren't offered the choice. So we need to understand what the risks and benefits are and also how we should best deliver these women, even when it's the second twin or when it is the surprise full-term lady who's pushing when she shows up and there's a butt coming out of the vagina. We need to know what we're doing.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the things you said were controversial at that meeting, at that presentation. You mentioned that they claim the size of the pelvis was different when depending on what position the woman was. So all fours on hands and knees compared to being on her back. This is definitely something that I've heard quite a bit. And supposedly it's one of the reasons why the Gaskin maneuver exists for shoulder dystocia. We talked about that previously because there's the belief that it suddenly makes the pelvis expand, like the bones expand and then the baby fits out better.
Well, as far as the Gaskin's maneuver and pelvic size, which is maybe what's relevant here because in the Gaskin's maneuver, the mother is in the all fours position. There have been studies, radiographic studies, that show that the dimensions that matter of the pelvis for shoulder dystocia are not different. In fact, they might even be worse in some positions. So Gaskin's maneuver is really just upside down Roberts maneuver. It does change the functional angle that the shoulders approach the pubic symphysis through that rotation of the pelvis, but you do commonly hear nurses, even when mom are on their backs, encourage the mother, they pull her legs back while they're pushing or something like that, and they'll say things like it's going to open their pelvis up or make their pelvis bigger by having their legs back or things like that. So people talk about making the pelvis bigger with those positions anecdotally.
I'm sure we've all suggested that at some point while we were encouraging women to push.
Well, it does. Sure, we do. But it does change the angles of approach. It changes the angle the symphysis pubis approaches the shoulders or even the presenting head or whatever when you do that. But it doesn't change the obstetric conjugate, the dimensions that matter in any particular way. So some people also talk about the functional size of the pelvis. And if by changing the angles of the pelvis, you increase the functional size of the pelvis relative to the anatomy that you need at that point fitting through, then perhaps that's true and it's an okay statement. Now, there is a study. There's a couple of MRI studies of pelvimetry. We're going to talk about the first one in a few minutes, but there's a more recent one published in Denmark in the Acta Obstetrica in 2021 that claims to be the first to measure pelvic capacity. It's not, but they define capacity in a different way, with MRI in various positions and at different gestational ages. So they had 44 women agree to receive an MRI at 20 weeks and again at 32 weeks in three different maternal positions, which were the kneeling squat position, the semilithotomy position, and the supine position. The anatomic idea is that there may be some laxity or free movement of the pelvic joints, and that a particular position may be better than another position for emphasizing that laxity, stressing that laxity in these joints, and then creating more space.
Okay, so I'm curious how they got women 32 weeks pregnant into a narrow MRI tube while they were kneeling in a squat. I mean, did they have them just not actually do that, but lie on their backs and simulate that position, or did they just have a massive MRI machine?
They actually included a picture of this so you could know what they were doing. So the women would lay down on their knees and legs and then squat over their bellies while holding a pillow or something so that she could fit into the machine. So it's actually closer to the all fours position, except that her thighs are much, much more flexed than would normally be the case in a true all fours position. Otherwise, as you said, she wouldn't fit into the machine.
Okay, so maybe it's possible that those positions they used maybe don't put quite as much stress on the joints as just straight up hands and knees do, but I guess that's the best they could do. And I don't know, sometimes we still put women in that same knee to chest position if there's like a fetal decel to relieve pressure on the cord or on the placenta or something. So that's still good information, I suppose. But what did they find? I'm assuming that the pelvis does get bigger with gestational age increase because the ligaments get more lax. So hopefully they found that. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, they did find that there was an increase in total pelvic capacity from 20 weeks to 32 weeks, both in the inlet and the outlet in all three positions. So it does get bigger. And that would continue, obviously, to term, we think. Now, at 32 weeks, they found that the supine position had a larger pelvic inlet than the semilithotomy position, but that the semilithotomy position was 2 millimeters bigger in the pelvic outlet. And shifting from supine to kneeling squat position increased the midplane in the pelvic outlet by up to 1 centimeter in some women.
So the kneeling squat is beneficial then?
Well, not necessarily. So this is the problem with this and older studies is what measurement are we looking at and which one matters? They took a ton of different measurements, and it depends on what you think is important for effectuating delivery. So I'll give you some actual measurements. The obstetric conjugate at 32 weeks was an average of 12.7 centimeters in the supine position, 12.6 in the semilithotomy, and 12.3 in the kneeling squat. So from that perspective, supine is best. And in the same way, the diagonal and anatomic conjugates were as good or better than the others in the supine position. But the anteroposterior outlet was 8.9 centimeters in the supine, but 9.8 in the kneeling squat position and 9.1 in the semilithotomy position. So that's where the kneeling squat wins, is in this anteroposterior outlet measurement.
Okay, so just describe that measurement, anteroposterior outlet.
Yeah, and they have a picture. But it's the measurement between the tip of the coccyx as it rolls forward and the most distal inside edge of the symphysis pubis. It's the shortest dimension between the pubic bone and the tip of the coccyx.
Okay, got it. Well, that kind of makes sense. But there is a lot of mobility in the coccyx. And we know that when you squat down, the muscles and their positions will pull the coccyx back and up by about a centimeter because of that mobility. So that particular measurement does get bigger, but most people, I don't think, believe that's the deciding factor in whether a baby can come out or not, because that is actually going to retract anyway at the time of delivery, regardless of what position you're in, because of that mobility. It's the more rigid, I think, obstetric conjugate is what matters, because that does not as easily move out of the way as the coccyx does. So we really probably shouldn't focus as much on the coccyx because that's going to move anyway. We should focus on what can make the obstetric conjugate the most favorable, because that will not necessarily just open itself up just because the baby is passing through, whereas the coccyx will.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you have to be careful when people talk about MRI pelvimetry, and we'll have another example of this in a few minutes, in the pelvis, because there's a bunch of different measurements, but you need to understand which measurements are important for which part of birth and for which presentation of birth. And the bottom line is the obstetric conjugate is usually the limiting factor, and that's better, and according to the study, in the supine position. So, of course, the true believers will still argue that this study validates the folklore that the pelvis is bigger in the squatting position because of this dimensionality. But overall, for what matters, supine and dorsal orthotomy are actually superior. Think about it as a ring that has laxity in it. And so if you squish it in the anterior to posterior dimension, it gets bigger in the lateral dimension. And that's true. It does happen. And so kneeling squat gives you more lateral space as well, as we'll see, but it doesn't give you more anterior to posterior space. And that's what matters about getting a baby out.
So it sounds like the speakers of this presentation were probably wrong about this point, about the squat actually opening the pelvis in an important way. But does that mean that delivering a breech baby on all fours is not beneficial? Because admittedly, it's not the conventional teaching. All of our very well-proven maneuvers for delivery are premised on the patient being supine, and it's not necessarily easy to invert those maneuvers. But maybe they're trying to suggest that we can overcome that just by doing more hands and knees deliveries, and then we can also see the benefits for ourselves.
Yeah, there could be other reasons why this is beneficial. And of course, there's no randomized controlled trial that's able to tell us what the best way is to deliver a breech baby. I will say for people that are reinvigorated about breech delivery, one of the things that they'll say is all those old trials use the dorsal supine or lithotomy position, and now we're doing it this way. And so clearly that's why it works better. And so that's not evidence that's actually been established. That's just a way of kicking the ball on down the field and saying, well, we're doing it different than they did, so the data doesn't apply. So there is no direct analysis, and that forces us to make assumptions about what's the best way from other indirect sources of information, like these measurements. And I think that's the point of that discussion. But there is a paper coming out in July of this year that's already available as a pre-release, and I'll put a link to that, uses a simulation model to measure the amount of force applied to the fetal neck during delivery in both positions. So this is a mannequin with pressure sensors and things like that. And they found that the lowest force of the fetal neck on the fetal neck was recorded for delivery in the all fours position with a mean force of 58.7 newtons. Now, this is a spontaneous delivery with no maneuvers, just it falls out essentially. This compared to delivery in the lithotomy position with a mean force of 81.5 newtons. And in that spontaneous delivery thing, that might be the difference in the coccyx placement, right? Because it takes some force to displace the coccyx and those muscles. These forces both went up as you added more weight to the fetus, bigger baby, more force. But they also looked at how much force was applied to deliver the fetal head without a contraction or in a normal simulating an assisted birth, using something called the Frank's nudge maneuver in all fours position, and that resulted in a force of 118 newtons. And then in the lithotomy position, they used the Bracht maneuver, which is what's routinely used in Germany where the study was done. And so to be clear, the Bracht maneuver to deliver the fetal head generated less force than the Frank's nudge maneuver. So it was better than the Frank's nudge maneuver. But they found that the Marceau-Smellie-Vite maneuver, which is part of basic obstetric teaching in the United States and what we normally do, generated the lowest force of all for delivery with only 74.6 newtons. Now, that's more than the spontaneous delivery amount, but it's actually less than the spontaneous delivery of the lithotomy position by forcing the flexion of the head. And so this was preferable for uncomplicated deliveries. It was better than the Frank's nudge maneuver in all fours position. And they actually saw the highest fetal neck force during the Frank's nudge maneuver in all fours position. And that's important because that's what folks are advocating for the all fours delivery is this Frank's nudge maneuver.
So we're back to eponyms, I see.
Well, none of these people are women.
So let's explain to our listeners what these different maneuvers are. Because a lot of people probably know what the Marceau-Smellie-Vite is, but at least the Bracht and the Frank's nudge most people probably are not familiar with, at least in the US. So the Bracht maneuver works really well for uncomplicated breech deliveries. The mother is in the dorsal lithotomy supine position. After the baby's arms are delivered, the baby is grasped by the hips. They're, in all of these cases, the sacrum is anterior, so the baby is facing the mother's back. So the hips are lifted with the delivering provider's both hands up towards the maternal stomach, not pulling any traction. They're basically just pivoting the baby. And this really just encourages the baby's head and neck to swing around the mom's pubic bone. And at the same time, an assistant is applying suprapubic pressure. So they're also pushing the baby's head down around the mom's pubic bone from the outside. And as you said, that's the standard practice in Germany and probably most of Europe. In the US, we tend to emphasize the more so smelly vite. It's somewhat similar. There are a lot of modifications and a lot of eponym controversy, but whatever you call it, this is how we would do it in the US. So there is still that suprapubic pressure by an assistant to help flex the baby's head and push it around the pubic bone. But the key difference is instead of pulling up the baby's hips, the delivering provider puts their fingers on the baby's two cheekbones on the maxilla and then kind of gently pulls them down so that they're kind of pulling the baby's chin down to the chest. And so that forces the baby's head to flex without putting any pressure on the neck. And then at that point, they can either kind of gently pull on the baby's shoulder or body or whatever they have the best grip on and get the baby's the head to deliver out. But then really the new one here for a lot of people is probably the Frank's nudge maneuver. And I'm still trying to fully understand this, but it's an interesting eponym because it was actually named after the doctor's first name. It was named for Dr. Frank Leuven, who is German. So there's an article you can read from April 2016 where he describes this method. And he talks about 269 breech vaginal deliveries that were performed in Germany. 229 of them were in the all fours position, but then about, I think, 45 of them did not come out spontaneously. And so he used this maneuver to affect their delivery. So this is where, of course, the mother has to be on all fours for this maneuver. And again, the baby is facing the mother's back. So when the mom's on all fours, and the baby's sacrum is anterior, the baby is now facing the ceiling. And once all of the rest of the body has come out and you're ready to deliver the head and it's not just falling out, the obstetrician is supporting the baby's body and then they actually push the baby's shoulders downward, like towards the floor a little bit, towards the mom's pubic bone. And then that force encourages the head to flex. So this, I suppose this would be analogous to in a supine delivery, trying to pull the baby's shoulders upwards towards the ceiling. But with those other maneuvers we already discussed, the Bracht or the more so smelly vite, that would not be necessary. And as we just discussed, doing that puts more force on the neck than any other possible way of breech vaginal delivery. So unnecessary and perhaps harmful even.
Exactly. And so this is the methodology that's being used at George Washington University, where this group is from, for most of the deliveries that they've been doing. Now, in that data set that you mentioned, that was published from Frankfurt, 67% of the babies were Frank breeches, 14% were complete, and another 11% were actually incomplete in the planned vaginal delivery group. They had no patients in the planned vaginal delivery group who had an obstetric conjugate less than or equal to 12 centimeters, so they did use imaging, particularly for the nulliparous patients, to make sure that that was true. They also had no growth-restricted fetuses, they excluded those, and no fetuses with known birth defects. Pregnancies with any of those problems were delivered by cesarean. In the planned vaginal delivery group, they had 2.5% of newborns with an Apgar at 5 minutes of less than 7, and one that had seizures in the first 24 hours of life, compared to only 0.3% with planned cesareans and no seizures in that group. Overall, they found that 1.4% of the planned vaginal delivery group had serious morbidity related to the motor delivery, compared to 0.6% with the planned cesarean group.
Yeah, and of the 269 vaginal deliveries, I already mentioned this, but only 40 of them were delivered supine. The rest were in hands and knees. But they concluded, based on this comparison of 229 versus 40, that the length of the first and second stage was shorter in those 229 patients that were not on their backs. Most of those were spontaneous deliveries, completely unassisted. And they show a lot of other potential differences between the two positions for breech vaginal delivery. But only having 40 in the one group probably doesn't allow for very many statistically valid comparisons.
Yeah, that's right. And you also have maybe the world's expert in delivering patients in all fours, comparing his skill set, which I'm sure is impressive, to a very small number of women delivering in lithotomy position, which isn't his preferred method. Of course, there's also no randomization, and they acknowledge that such comparisons are problematic from this sort of retrospective data that they had, particularly the finding of a quicker first and second stage of labor associated with the birthing position. That's something that's not found in other literature, but this study has inspired folks to try these methods, and that's what this talk was about, essentially. But I also note that the two authors of this paper, along with Dr. Leuven, who are called Kenneth Johnson and Betty Ann Davis, are the same authors of the infamous 2005 publication in the British Medical Journal, which claimed that planned home birth with certified professional midwives in the United States was associated with lower rates of interventions, but similar neonatal outcomes to hospital births in the United States. Now, that paper was rejected by dozens of publications for publication for various reasons. It was widely criticized by many communities after its publication for what appears to be really deliberate twisting of data and very at least selective data reporting to come up with that conclusion. That paper went on to do really a lot of harm, and the authors, those two authors, are major advocates in their professional lives for home birth, and to say that they're biased is a great understatement. So I used to actually give a grand rounds about that particular paper, and the authors were even forced later to write a couple of follow-up responses because of really some rather bold obfuscation of the truth. They really were selective in how they presented data and made unfair comparisons. And then it was released with a major press release by their organization, and everybody all of a sudden was claiming that hospitals didn't need to exist, essentially. So to see their names on a case registry paper like this, whose principal conclusion is that upright birthing positions are associated with the quicker stages of labor, should be viewed with great skepticism. Now, the Frank's Nedge maneuver, as you said, was only used in about 45, I think, of those upright or all four deliveries. And I do think it's a useful technique and a skill to have if you happen to find yourself with a woman delivering in that position, a breech baby. But there's certainly no evidence that it should be the primary technique that we use. The presenters at this ACOG talk admitted that when they had difficulty delivering, then they turned the patient back over onto the supine or dorsal lithotomy position to employ other maneuvers, which could include the things you already mentioned, but also potentially the use of Piper forceps for an entrapped head. So I certainly wouldn't create a program intentionally that intends to deliver women in this position based upon this paper that we've been discussing, when we know that the traditional method that we use in the United States is associated with far less traction forces on the fetal neck than the other maneuvers, and also that the dorsal lithotomy position allows for the definitive methods needed that are available to us to safely deliver the baby and provides a bigger obstetric conjugate in the process.
We should talk about that 2005 paper sometime, because there is a great deal of confusion that's been created by that publication. It probably should have never been published, but we're pretty much out of time, so we can put that on our list for the future. The other thing, though, that you were telling me was that they really were negative about epidurals and also about objective pelvimetry using MRI or X-ray. So I think we might still have a little time to hit on those really quickly before we wrap up.
Yeah, well, I did promise to talk about the other MRI paper, and I saved it for now because it's this group again. So these are the same authors. They did a paper in the Gray Journal in 2014 that made the claim that the pelvis got bigger with a squatting position. That's the claim that was being referenced by the presenter at the meeting. And what they claimed in that paper, based upon an MRI analysis of women, was that the average transverse diameters were larger in the kneeling squat position. That claim is what they kept saying over and over again, about 2 centimeters, because this transverse measurement got 2 centimeters bigger. But in their own study, in that MRI study that was done very similar to the one we talked about before, the anatomic conjugate was longer in the dorsal supine position, as were the obstetric and diagonal conjugates. And so you've got to realize those are the numbers that matter when giving birth. The lithotomy or position was better than the squatting position for the numbers that matter. So those numbers were not bigger in their study. So they keyed in on this transverse bispinous or bitubrous diameter. And it again just shows the bias of the authors. They want to prove some efficacy or benefit of this hands and knees position at all costs. So they found a difference in this transverse distance and then made a claim that somehow that was beneficial, or just the general claim that the pelvis is bigger, when in fact having a smaller transverse distance is probably what allows for having a larger obstetric conjugate. And these numbers are like 12 or 13 centimeters anyway. They're not the limiting force. So their MRI study actually found that the dorsal supine position was better for the measurements that mattered about giving birth. So it's a bit disingenuous to say that it makes the pelvis bigger and to parrot it over and over again. And I found that that was one of the things at the meeting that sort of upset me the most.
Okay. Well, quickly on the epidurals too. Doesn't it make sense that if anything, an epidural would relax the pelvic floor muscles and allow for less resistance against the fetal head as it's being delivered? I know sometimes a dense epidural can make it harder to flip someone on all fours and back again, especially if that they're all about the all fours, and maybe it can contribute overall to a slower second stage. But it sounds like they're actually trying to claim that you need a tight and active pelvic floor to somehow help expel the baby somehow.
Yes, one of the presenters specifically said you needed these muscles working to push the baby out. And that's just not how the pelvic floor works. You need the pelvic floor relaxed to push the baby out. Most importantly, though, studies don't show that epidurals change the rate of vaginal delivery, at least in cephalic pregnancies. And most programs around the world who are working on implementing breech delivery programs are certainly not discouraging epidurals. And if anything, they believe that patients should get one so that they have a more relaxed pelvic floor, and that will help facilitate a vaginal birth and certainly allow you to use Piper forceps or things like that if you need them. So this particular group holds an outlying view of this and have not presented evidence to justify it.
Yeah, and I would think discouraging epidurals is certainly one way to scare a lot of patients away from going the vaginal route if they're considering it for their breech delivery. Yeah. And weren't they also against oxytocin?
Yeah, I say that discouraging epidural thing also happens with VBACs. There are a lot of people who tell women with trials of labor that they can't get epidurals because we won't know if your uterus ruptures from the change in pain. And that's a great way of discouraging trials of labor as well. But yeah, they, as far as oxytocin, I do think they were actually probably more reasonable about that. They said that they would debate it on a case-by-case basis. The midwife who spoke seemed to believe that oxytocin was a negative for labor and that it made labor patterns bad or something like that. But I also think they just may have a hesitance about using oxytocin because the need for oxytocin might suggest that there's some sort of dystocia, something wrong, and that maybe a cesarean is a safer route if they don't progress. And the ACOG bulletin is also very conservative about oxytocin.
Okay, well, that's fair, I suppose, in the absence of good clinical trials. But I think most places that are implementing breech vaginal delivery programs are okay with oxytocin.
I think that's the case. Yeah. If it's just, if you met all the metrics and you know how big their pelvis and the baby is and they just need some augmentation. Yeah.
And you said they were not very supportive or encouraging about doing pelvimetry before breech vaginal delivery.
Yeah. The question was asked and they were just dismissive of it as a waste of money. Not a great scientific answer, but the ACOG bulletin we talked about does suggest that your criteria for breech delivery at term should include a gestational age greater than 37 weeks, a frank or complete breech presentation, no fetal anomalies, an adequate maternal pelvis, and an estimated fetal weight between 2,500 and 4,000 grams. Now, this isn't considering the question of breech versus classical cesarean for early preterm babies. We could talk about that more at a different time. Classical cesareans have a lot of morbidity. Small babies, breeches are a completely different subject. But and there's also some variation about which second twins you should do breech too. We should talk about those things maybe at some point. But I think that the questioning of how you determine what an adequate maternal pelvis is where pelvimetry comes in. And how do you do that? Well, you might be able to do it just because she's had children of a certain size before without any event, so a clinically proven pelvis. But if not, especially if she's an oliparous patient, MRI pelvimetry just makes a lot of sense to me. In fact, Dr. Leuven did a trial in 2019, I'll put a link to that, in which he showed that MRI pelvimetry in oliparous women who were planning a breech vaginal delivery was viable, it was accurate, and it was useful. They found that the obstetric conjugate, again, correlated best with the rate of vaginal deliveries in the oliparous women at term, not the transverse distances and not the anterior-posterior diameters. And they looked at that, actually, but they found that it was the obstetric conjugate that mattered the most, and that was bigger in women in the dorsal lithotomy or supine position that we know from these other studies. But overall, Dr. Leuven and their program was supportive of MRI pelvimetry, particularly for nulliparous patients, and they developed their criteria around that. So I think it makes sense if you're having a woman who is nulliparous, who really has failed an external cephalic version. She's really insisting upon this route of delivery. I think that that gives you a lot of information about how to counsel her accurately about the risks.
Well, all right. I think we should wrap up. Looking forward to getting some interesting emails after this one.
I think there will be a few, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the Thinking About OBGYN website will have links to a lot of the papers we brought up today, and we will be back in a couple weeks.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.